Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of How We Survive. It's a podcast from Marketplace. In 1986, before I was a journalist, I was flying for the Navy.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It was the Cold War, and my first deployments were intercepting Russian bombers. Today, though, there's another threat out there. Climate change.
This could be the warmest year on record.
Climate change is here.
Temperatures here are warming faster than anywhere on Earth.
And while the threat seems new, the Pentagon's been funding studies on climate change since the 1950s.
I think we will put our troops and our forces at higher risk if we don't recognize the impact of climate change.
This season, we go to the front lines of the climate crisis to see how the military is preparing for the threat. Listen to How We Survive, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ukraine's president has a plan for victory against Russia. It would require Ukrainian membership in NATO.
We have to stop thinking that there's no way that Ukraine can join NATO as long as the war is ongoing, because that is just a signal to Vladimir Putin, therefore keep the war going.
A veteran U.S. diplomat weighs in on Zelensky's strategy for winning the war. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also today, demand for electricity is making it increasingly difficult to stay on track to reach global emissions targets.
We are in a world where the climate is losing out.
Plus, why long-distance runners from Kenya are facing scrutiny about doping. And a pilot program to reintroduce cattle in the Scottish Highlands also wants to show people
just how exciting and awesome nature and wild things can be.
All that today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us today. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky made a rare appearance before Parliament today in Kyiv. He offered details on his five-point victory plan for ending the war with Russia.
Жити вільно, жити суверенно на своїй землі і за своїм законом.
Zelensky's address today comes after visits with the Biden administration and European leaders trying to sell them on the same plan.
Veteran diplomat Kurt Volker is following this closely. He's a former U.S. ambassador to NATO and served as Washington's special representative for Ukraine from 2017 to 2019. Volker says there were no surprises in Zelensky's speech.
None of this is new. This is not rocket science here. Russia is firing at will at Ukraine from sanctuary inside Russia. And the West does not have a plan for how to ensure that Ukraine prevails. So Zelensky has tried to fill the gap, but he's saying many of the same things that we have heard before. Yes, we need to approve the use of munitions long range to strike military targets inside Russia from which Russia is attacking Ukraine. We need to have a stronger deterrent against Russia in the future so that this war doesn't break out again. And the only deterrent that has been proven to work in Europe is NATO. So we've got to bring Ukraine into NATO if we actually want to see peace in Europe restored. I think what he's trying to do is put this debate over long-range use of weapons into a context that says this is not just us saying, oh, give us new toys. This is part of a strategy for how Ukraine prevails in this war.
One of the points is also, as you said, putting Ukraine on a pathway to NATO membership. But haven't Western allies made clear that that is not going to happen until this war is over?
Well, that's what the irony is on the one hand, at the Vilnius summit a year and a half ago and at the Washington summit in July of this year, NATO allies said, yes, Ukraine will become a member of NATO. But then they have not taken any action to make that a reality. What Zelensky has in mind, and I think what others are discussing in the corridors these days, is, yes, we need to help Ukraine strengthen its position on the battlefield so that Putin wants to end the war. But then we also need to make NATO membership a part of the solution.
Is there any scenario in which Ukraine could become part of NATO before the war is over?
Absolutely. I think that we have to stop thinking that there's no way that Ukraine can join NATO as long as the war is ongoing, because that is just a signal to Vladimir Putin, therefore keep the war going. We need to be signaling to Putin instead
there's no way you're going to come out of this better than you are now, so you better stop it. Look, we can bring Ukraine into NATO now. We can limit the application of the collective defense commitment to the territory that Ukraine actually controls. We will disagree over the occupied territory, but that won't be a military effort to retake it. It'll be a long-term political disagreement, and we have the means to actually pull this off. So it would be a way of reestablishing deterrence. What's important to understand is that we had a system in place in Europe for decades and decades and decades where Russia did not launch any major invasions. They launched a few minor ones in Ukraine in 2014, in Georgia in 2008, but no big ones because they were afraid of what the response would be. That deterrence of Russia has evaporated, and they felt that they could go ahead and attack Ukraine with impunity. Bringing them into NATO, setting limits, but setting clear limits about what we will defend and what we will help with, will help reestablish deterrence.
I would imagine that leaders in Washington also, at least, are distracted by the upcoming election. And I wonder how much, you know, a response to this plan after November depends on who wins the election.
Well, that's a great question, because I do think that is part of the current thinking of the Biden administration, is not to take very public and visible steps now that could impact Vice President Harris's campaign. So there is a caution not only about, you know, Russian escalation, there's also a caution about having an impact on the presidential election. So they are then thinking, well, maybe after the election, there's a window in which we can do a few more things. But the reality is, if Vice President Harris is elected, she will want to say, I'm in charge of this now, so don't handcuff me with things. And if former President Trump is elected, he's going to say, I don't care what the Biden administration does in its last months in office, I'm going to set policy.
Ambassador Volker, it wasn't so long ago that Ukraine's leaders were talking about taking back all of the territory that Russia had occupied, including Crimea, the Donbass. Has that goal changed at all after nearly 3 years of a grinding war?
That is still the goal. That they do not accept Russia's occupation of any parts of Ukrainian territory. But I think they are realizing that they're not going to be able on their own to retake that territory, nor are they going to be able to do it with Western assistance either. And so they're looking at saying, we need to save the country, so it has to be part of Europe, part of the EU, part of NATO. Then we can disagree about Russia's occupation, very much as we disagreed about Soviet occupation of Eastern Germany or the Baltic states. We didn't take them back militarily, but we also didn't accept it. And, you know, after 40 years or so, that territory was reverted to its rightful owner. So that is something I think the Ukrainians have in mind, is that we can't do it now, but we can't give up on the goal, so we have to find a way to survive and prosper.
How has the war in the Middle East affected Ukraine's effort to keep attention and support from the West?
This is a very interesting question, because you can't understate the degree to which Iran and Russia are supporting each other right now. All of the drones that Russia is using to attack Ukraine's energy infrastructure, its cities, its civilian population, its civilian infrastructure, these are all provided by Iran or under licensing manufactured in Russia as Iranian manufactured drones. So Iran is giving massive support to Russia's war effort. In return, Russia is giving a lot of political cover, probably also some technology for Iran in its launching of this series of conflicts in the Middle East. Hamas did not attack Israel. Hezbollah has not attacked Israel. The Houthis have not launched without Iran's training, financing, equipping, supporting. And that has all occurred with Russia's endorsement. I think Russia feels that by distracting the West in the Middle East, take some of the pressure off of Russian forces in Ukraine. What we have to do is flip this entire logic and say that we understand there's a correlation here. We have to go after the instigators of the conflict and make it clear to them, Russia and Iran, that they pay a price for doing this.
Kurt Volker is a distinguished fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis. He's a former U.S. ambassador to NATO and was the U.S. Special Representative for Ukraine from 2017 to 2019.
When space rocks fall into our atmosphere and then land here on Earth without completely burning up, they're called meteorites. The place where most meteorites have been found through history is on the vast ice desert of Antarctica. But they show up in other desert regions like the southwestern United States and in northern Argentina in a place called Campo del Cielo. It's home to some of the largest meteorites ever discovered. These space rocks are also being stolen, which the authorities in Argentina are trying to stop. Michael Fox has our story, which actually begins in Virginia.
A few years ago, my daughter Rosa fell in love with a $20 meteorite necklace at a gift shop in a state park on the east coast of the United States. We got it for her. I asked her to describe it. She says it's about the size of a coin.
But it weighs like 10 coins. And it's small and blackish brown and it looks like metal, like a metal rock.
That's because it's made of mostly iron and nickel. The box this meteorite came in said it came from the Campo del Cielo meteorite field in Argentina. It took us over 3 years, but we finally got there. 8 miles in from the closest town over a dirt road. Today, it's a nature reserve. The first thing you see when you step into the parking lot is what looks like a large bowl in the ground, about half the size of a football field. It's a crater made by a massive meteorite, one of thousands that peppered this whole area roughly 4,000 years ago. Just behind it is an interactive museum with hundreds of meteorites on display.
Es magnífica la experiencia. Amén de ello.
The experience is magnificent, says Alexis Saul, who's visiting with his wife and daughter from a couple of hours away. It's so important for the world. We need to value this place so much more than we do. Groups of green parrots fly overhead. On a short walk around the area, you come across roughly a dozen huge meteorites, including the third and fourth largest in the world, weighing almost 31 and 29 metric tons, respectively. They sit on large circular slabs of concrete. You can walk right up to them, touch them, hug them. It's pretty incredible. Angeline Santillan has worked as the main guide at the park for the last decade. She says there's no place like this on the planet.
Este es único, porque si bien el primero más grande está en África.
This is unique, because although the largest meteorite is in Africa, you don't have the ability to get up close like you do with these meteorites, she says. But there's a problem. Theft. Santillan says the quantity is impossible to calculate, but it's happened for decades, and it's still happening.
Se robaron meteoritos en el Chaco. Sí, el colmo. ¿Estás seguro lo que está?
That's a news report from 2019, when a group of people were caught trying to steal three large meteorites. This June, two people were detained again in western Argentina, trying to make off with 77 stolen space rocks. Back in 1991, a U.S. meteorite collector even tried to steal El Chaco, then the third largest meteorite in the world. Meteorites of varying sizes used to litter the ground here. Here's a clip from a 2014 documentary about the Campo del Cielo meteorite field.
Había, por ejemplo, estancias acá cerquita en el hermoso campo que tenían toda la entrada del campo, del camino, de los dos lados.
They aren't easy to find now, says one Argentine researcher in the field. But there were plantations where the entire road in was lined on both sides with meteorites. Every rock you found here was a meteorite. The Argentine state has tried to respond. Since the 1990s, laws have prohibited the removal and sale of the country's meteorites. In 2004, Argentina passed a law declaring the meteorites a cultural patrimony of the nation. Rogelio Daniel Acevedo is a geologist and meteorite specialist who's retired from Argentina's space and research agency, CONICET.
Entonces no se pueden comercializar. Ejemplo, yo encuentro un meteorito en el campo.
So they can't be sold, he says. If I find one on my property, I don't have to turn it in, but I can't sell it.
Es cierto que los mercadillos del mundo.
Nevertheless, he explains, in the markets of the world where precious metals and rocks are sold, there is always an Argentine meteorite for sale. Be that at a gift shop in the United States or online. A quick search on eBay reveals dozens of listings just for Campo del Cielo meteorites.
Pero sí, es lamentable. Ya el tema de lo que es contrabando es.
It's really unfortunate, says Santillan. This question of meteorite theft and contraband is really hard to control. She says that even the sale of Argentina's meteorites abroad is still illegal under Argentine law, but hard to regulate.
Y mi mensaje sería que no los compren ni que tampoco los vendan.
Her message? Please don't buy or sell our meteorites. This is something that belongs to us, she says. Something that's unique, world heritage. But Santillán says these meteorites are just used, sold, and commercialized, like everything today. And that, she says, is a shame. For The World, I'm Michael Fox, Campo del Cielo, Argentina.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The demand for electricity across the globe is surging, even faster than experts had predicted. That is the main takeaway in a new report from the International Energy Agency. The IEA puts out a comprehensive study on global energy trends every year. This latest one suggests that skyrocketing energy demands are going to make it difficult for countries to move away from fossil fuels and slow the impacts of climate change. Tim Gould is one of the lead authors of the report. He's the chief energy economist at the IEA and spoke with us earlier today from Paris.
Electricity is really central to our modern lives. We're electrifying more of the things that we do. So in some countries, we're electrifying more of the heat that we need during the winter. Cooling demand is increasing very rapidly, and that's also because of the increasingly warm temperatures that we have in many parts of the world. And there are new uses as well from data centers and AI. And lots of industrial demand is also moving across to electricity, particularly in the lighter industrial sectors. So if you put all of that together, you do get a very bullish outlook for global electricity use.
Just how much added electricity demand are you expecting in the next few years?
So if you're looking at the period between now and 2035, you're adding the equivalent of a Japan to global electricity demand each year. So that's in the terminology that the electricity people use. That's about 1,000 terawatt hours each year. That's really a substantial amount. That's about half of what the European Union uses each year. And so that's really a rapid expansion. If we were to get on track for a more ambitious energy transition, those numbers would be even higher because we would be moving more rapidly. We would be electrifying more end uses more quickly, heat, transport, and so on. And we would also be starting to use electricity to produce low emissions fuels like low emissions hydrogen that would help with decarbonizing some of the more difficult industrial sectors.
Even if electricity generation by clean power keeps up with an increase in electricity demand, it's not really cutting into what is currently produced by fossil fuels in your projections. Is that right?
That's entirely right. So, obviously we need to do much more than just meet the growth in demand. We actually need to cut into the emissions associated with the stuff that we have already today. And you're also completely right that the pace of change thus far is a long way from what we would need to see globally in order to get us on track for national or global climate goals. And so the net zero targets that you mentioned. And I think there, you have to pay particular attention to what's happening in developing economies, because there are a number of issues where the private sector doesn't yet see the balance of risk and reward that would it need to invest at scale. And so you're not seeing these clean energy projects coming through as quickly as you would need to.
There's a lot of new oil and gas capacity coming online in the next handful of years, according to your analysis, even as countries, say they are moving away from these fuel sources. So what's going on there?
The demand for electricity is increasing more rapidly than energy demand in general. So it's been increasing at roughly double the pace of overall energy demand. And we think that that gap is going to increase. So it's not 2-1, but it's more like 6-1 over the coming decades. And that electricity is going to increasingly come from clean sources. But when we look at the fuels that we use, so the oil that goes into transportation, or the gas that goes into industrial sectors, or the coal that goes into some industrial sectors and into power, we're still using an awful lot of that. The balance in some of those markets is also changing. We've had a difficult few years in the energy sector with a very turbulent time through COVID and then the global energy crisis that followed Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and particularly the cuts that were made to Russia's gas supply to Europe. What we're now identifying is that we are moving into a situation where you have what might be called more comfortable energy balances for some of these fossil fuels. And that's likely to result in downward pressure on prices. And one of the reasons for that is because you're getting lots of additional supply. On the oil side, it's additional supply from the Americas, from the US, from Canada, from Brazil, from Guyana. On gas side, also lots of large gas producers around the world are planning to step up production. But another reason why you're getting these more comfortable balances is because demand is not growing as fast as it used to be. Particularly on the oil side now, demand growth is slowing quite noticeably.
Who do you see as the winners and losers that this report has revealed when we're thinking the climate or energy producers or end users? What stands out to you?
So I think, you know, we are in a world where the climate is losing out. And you can see that in the way that accumulated emissions are intensifying the incidence of extreme weather events at the moment, sort of heat waves and floods at the moment, so that we are doing damage and we have been doing damage for some time to the planet from the way our energy system operates. We have to turn that around. And that does risk creating winners and losers in other parts of the energy system. And I think one of the things that policymakers are really, you know, looking at very carefully is managing that process so that you maximize the opportunities that are available from a social and economic perspective, you know, and you make sure you look after the groups that might be disadvantaged by that process of change. But we see that those benefits, both in terms of employment, sustainable growth, and of course, for the environment, air quality, and for emissions, they greatly outweigh the downside elements.
That's Tim Gould, the chief energy economist at the International Energy Agency in Paris. Ahead this hour, the effects of climate change have parts of Morocco gripped in drought. We'll hear solutions Moroccans are trying to mitigate the problem.
Here's an update to a story we covered over the summer. In July, it seemed inevitable that Açık Radyo, or open radio in Turkish, would be going off the air. Broadcast authorities in Turkey fined the station in April and revoked its license after a guest on a news program mentioned a remembrance day for the Armenian genocide.
The 1915 mass killing of Armenians by massacre, forced marches, and starvation is still a taboo topic in Turkey. The government there refuses to tolerate accusations of genocide. During World War I, the Muslim Ottomans considered Christian Armenians living in Turkey potential inside agitators. Somewhere between 600,000 and 1.5 million were killed or driven out.
And now, because a genocide commemoration was mentioned on air, Açık Radyo has gone dark. One listener told The World that she enjoyed the station like an old friend, and that included the opinions she did not agree with.
But still, I listen it, you know, even I don't think that way.
DJ Omer Madra read a statement today just before 1 o'clock when the station went off the air.
Evet, o zaman bitiriyoruz artık tüm Açık Radyo dinleyicilerine.
Yes, we are ending now, Madra said. To all of Open Radio's listeners and supporters, we thank you. Restating the station's motto, he declared one final time that Open Radio will stay open to all the sounds, colors, and the vibrations of the universe.
And with that Beach Boys classic, Good Vibrations, Açık Radyo closed up shop after 29 years and 11 months on the air. It had been the longest-running community radio station in Turkey. Staffers called the closing a blow to freedom of speech and media in Turkey. They say they may reopen somehow online and will continue a legal fight to regain their license.
You're listening to The World.
In Morocco, people are learning to adapt to their new climate reality. That means finding new strains of seeds that can survive with less water and getting farmers to stop using sprinklers in favor of drip hoses.
We are using only drop by drop because you reduce by four the consumption of water.
Moroccans in the face of extreme drought ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. At the Chicago Marathon on Sunday, Ruth Chepngetich made history.
Oh, Jerry,
The Kenyan marathoner didn't just win the race, she smashed the women's world record, crossing the finish line in just 2 hours, 9 minutes, and 56 seconds.
The win was so extraordinary that some are questioning whether it's valid, and they are pointing to Kenya's troubled history with doping. The World's Bianca Hillier covers sports for our show. Before we talk about the doping situation, Bianca, break down this race for us. Just how fast was Chepngetich running?
Oh, it was a blistering pace that she was setting throughout the entire race. On average, she ran 4 minutes and 57 seconds per mile, taking nearly 2 minutes off of the previous world record. And Chepngetich has shown for years that she's a gutsy and talented runner. She's even won the Chicago Marathon twice before, but this was undoubtedly a whole new level.
Yeah, for sure. So what has reaction been like?
Some people are saying it was only a matter of time before a woman ran this fast. And Chicago is known as one of the fastest courses in the world. So if it was going to happen anywhere, it very well could be in Chicago. But the majority of people were stunned. And by stunned, I mean they were in disbelief. That has triggered a larger discussion, Marco. I mean, was Chepngetich's performance too good to be true? Was she doping? And to be clear, Chepngetich has never tested positive for any performance enhancing drugs, nor has she ever been found guilty of any doping violation. But still, it's a question that is looming over this incredible race.
But why the skepticism and this question coming up now, specifically for this runner and this world record? I mean, every world record is astounding since it bests the previous one and sets a new bar. What makes some people pounce on the notion that this runner's results should be questioned?
That's a really good question. Some people are pointing to sexism. You know, why is a woman's success being so widely interrogated when equally mind-blowing races by men are accepted as the truth? Others are pointing to the fact that she took over 4 minutes off of her own personal best, which is rare in elite marathoning. But the broader cloud around this has to do with Kenya's history with doping.
Right. So remind us briefly of that history.
Around 300 athletes from Kenya have been punished for using banned substances since 2015, and many of those are runners. And the list keeps growing, with the latest ban coming down on a runner just last week. The World Anti-Doping Agency, known as WADA, has stepped in to help clean things up, and officials there say they're happy with the progress Kenya is making. They've invested a lot of money and ramped up their testing, but many of the athletes who have tested positive and have been banned, their agents and managers are still working freely, including someone named Frederico Rosa, who happens to be Ruth Chepngetich's agent.
Okay, Frederico Rosa, how does his story tie into all of this doping discussion?
He's a longtime agent who's been connected to many high-profile runners, including previous Olympic champions and major marathon champions from Kenya, who later tested positive for banned substances. Rosa himself was arrested in 2016 and charged with 6 counts of doping athletes, though the charges were later dropped and he continues to deny any wrongdoing. He did not reply to my request for comment. So Chepngetich's connection to him is adding fuel to this discussion, and there is clearly still a long way to go for Kenyan athletics to earn the full trust of the public.
Got it. So, Bianca, what does Chepngetich herself have to say about all of this?
Right after the race, at a press conference, a journalist asked what she had to say to people who suspect her of doping.
You know, people must talk. So, I don't know.
She said people must talk, but otherwise avoided the question. I reached out to give her a chance to expand on that answer, but didn't hear back. In a statement today, though, Athletics Kenya, the country's national governing body for running, said the fact that people are singling her out is utterly unfair, and they urge people to give her the respect she deserves.
I mean, it seems like all this could be cleared up pretty quickly with a negative test from Sunday's race. Have officials released that information yet?
Well, they don't have that information yet. The U.S. Anti-Doping Agency confirmed to me that they collected drug tests on the day of the race, but they don't disclose which athletes were tested, and it'll be 6 to 10 weeks before those results come back anyway. And ultimately, drug tests are required for world records to be officially ratified, so that will all be checked out in the coming months.
That's the World's Bianca Hillier on the Sports Beat for us.
The Dominican Republic says it deported more than 10,000 Haitians last week. The plan in the DR is to continue doing the same every week until 500,000 people have been sent back across the border to Haiti. These are the largest such deportations in recent history on the Caribbean island of La Hispaniola, which both countries share. The World's Tibis Isaiah reports.
Maniaki Joseph doesn't even know exactly where she was dropped off last Friday. I'm one of these deported people, she tells me over the phone. Last week, Joseph was taking a walk in her neighborhood in the capital of Santo Domingo when she was stopped by Dominican authorities. She speaks with me in Spanish because she's been living in the Dominican Republic for many years. Her mom, who is Dominican, brought her to Santo Domingo when she was little, and she went to school there and later became a boxer. Joseph doesn't have a Dominican passport, but she says she has legal residence in the Dominican Republic. Because I didn't have my documents with me, I was treated like an animal, she says. Joseph was taken to a detention center and forced into a crowded truck with hundreds of people. Among them, she counted 25 children and two pregnant women. Joseph is now in a shelter with hundreds of other deportees in the border city of Belader. Katia Bonte is the director of the support group for refugees and repatriated Haitians. She spoke with me through an interpreter.
For the most part, they essentially go to workplaces of these people, and especially in construction sites where there are many Haitians working, and they take them. If you have dark skin, you're likely to be taken.
The targets of these police raids are mostly undocumented immigrants. But Bonte says she's seen Haitians with legal status in the Dominican Republic who have been taken and deported. She accused Dominican authorities of hunting down Haitians.
They steal their belongings, their phones, their money. They humiliate them. They insult them. They stack them into trucks to dump them on the border.
At least 500,000 Haitians live in the Dominican Republic, according to human rights groups, and deporting them was one of the main campaign promises of President Luis Abinader, who was re-elected earlier this year. A few weeks ago, protests erupted in Santo Domingo demanding that Abinader start fulfilling that promise. Many of the protesters say the Haitian migration is overwhelming public services like schools and hospitals. Renata Segura of the International Crisis Group says it's difficult to know how big of an issue that really is.
But obviously, if people start seeing many children that come to their schools where the resources aren't plentiful, you know, if they see that maybe the Haitians are taking some of the jobs that they might want, there is a certain sense of nativism.
But the Dominican Republic has also benefited from Haitian migration. Many immigrants perform low-paying jobs in hospitality and agriculture. The Haitian representative of the OAS, Gandhi Thomas, called the deportations a strategy of ethnic cleansing. It's not the first time President Abinader faces this kind of criticism, to which he usually responds, the Dominican Republic has been greatly affected economically by the crisis in Haiti and has offered more solidarity than any other country in the world. Renata Segura says Haitian deportees are returning to a difficult situation.
The Haitian state has been in shambles. The gangs have control of the majority of the capital, and it's very difficult to move gasoline, food, health supplies, etc.
A multinational security mission led by Kenya has done little to curb the violence in Haiti. And gangs are actively recruiting deportees, according to a recent report by Amnesty International.
You would be hard-pressed to find a more difficult situation for a person to be deported.
The Dominican Republic is not the only country expelling Haitians. The United States has consistently been repatriating them as well, though in smaller numbers. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isaya, Mexico City.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
In Niger, French language names are being dropped from street signs and other public places. The country's military leader called the French place names a reminder of the suffering and bullying that the country dealt with as a French colony. That is, according to the BBC. Niger has been ruled by a military junta since last year, and its relationship with the West has been rocky since then.
The Associated Press reports that Mexico is deploying 300 soldiers alongside 360 National Guard forces to the western state of Michoacán. The mission is to protect lime growers who say they're facing extortion threats by criminal gangs. In August, many lime warehouses stopped operating after cartels demanded a cut of their profits. Mexico's Department of Defense says the troops will be doing security work in warehouses, markets, and along supply routes. Mexico is one of the biggest exporters of limes in the world, and most of that fruit is sold to the U.S.
And an elephant success story in Kenya. In the Mwea National Reserve, the elephant population has thrived so much that the park is now relocating some of the animals to other places. The 16-square-mile park has capacity for 50 elephants, but the herd has grown to 156. Not great for the ecosystem there. So 100 elephants are being moved to a different, roomier national park in central Kenya.
And that is a few things you might have missed. There's an interesting rewilding effort about to launch in Scotland. A breed of genetically engineered cattle called taros are going to be released into the Scottish Highlands. Imagine a beefy longhorn beast. Richard Bunting is a spokesperson for Trees for Life, the group in the Highlands that's overseeing the project. He says the taros are meant to replicate their extinct cattle ancestor, the auroch.
Aurochs are very impressive creatures. You know, they're big, they're muscular, they have long horns, and they roamed across Europe for a very long time, hundreds of thousands of years, playing a really important role in the ecosystem. They were mega herbivores, but they finally went extinct about 400 years ago.
And how close are these new toros that will be reintroduced to the Highlands? How close are they to the aurochs in looks and abilities?
Well, these big cattle, they're called taros, and they have not been cloned from DNA from aurochs or anything like that, but they've been backbred. So scientists in Europe for about the past 10 to 20 years have been crossbreeding using ancient cattle breeds, the ones they think are most closely related to the aurochs. So what we've ended up with is this very large, very impressive breed of cattle, big, muscular, they look like aurochs. And in fact, aurochs were one of Europe's largest land mammals. At the shoulder, a bull would probably be something like 6 foot, something like that, maybe a bit bigger occasionally. And the taros that have been bred, they're effectively the same size as the aurochs.
What are the ecological benefits of reintroducing the species?
I think one starting point to mention would be that Scotland is currently one of the world's most nature-depleted countries for various reasons, including, you know, intensive land use and pollution and other issues over the years. And what we've got are big holes in the ecosystem, if you like, where we've lost certain species. Now, we haven't had the aurochs for a very long time in Scotland, but those big herbivores that graze play a really important role in the ecosystem. So that's what's interesting about this. We've got evidence from Europe that shows how the taros, their dung, for example, can fertilize the soil and bring ecological benefits, and plant seeds can get trapped in their fur. But the taros bring something else because they're so big and because they interact more actively with their environment. One example would be selective grazing. So they graze some areas quite intensively but leave others. So that opens up the landscape and that creates niches for different plant and animal species. And another, what we think could be an ecological game changer, if you like, with Taros, is something called bull pits. And these are scraped out by rutting bulls, sometimes to intimidate each other. And these create shallow bowls in the earth where the vegetation gets cleared. And then wildflowers and plants get the chance to gain a foothold there. And species from insects to birds to reptiles can all benefit from these shallow pits.
So there's the fertile cattle dung. There's another selling point with this reintroduction, that the Taros will store carbon. That's not really intuitive. Can you explain how that's going
to
work?
Storing atmospheric carbon to help tackle climate breakdown is a key part of this. So if you start having a really healthy functioning forest, for example, or a healthy wetland or a healthy grassland, all of which the Taros can help bring about, because you do need these big grazing herbivores in a fully functioning ecosystem, you end up with a flourishing ecosystem, you end up with healthier vegetation, that draws down more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So there's a carbon sequestration element to this, as well as the biodiversity boosting element to this.
Theoretically, could the Taros wander all over Scotland if they wanted to?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think for now, we've got this project underway. We'll aim to get those 15 or so individuals onto the Trees for Life estate, and we'll monitor it. But we're getting some interest from a lot of the neighbouring estates in the Highlands about this project, and there's a number of other projects and landowners around Scotland who are interested. We're looking at 15, but if you look at the Netherlands, for example, a smaller country and much more densely populated than Scotland, there are several hundred Taros there in the Netherlands already. So Scotland's got the space, but I think it's got one step at a time.
What excites you most about this project, Richard?
I think something we've got missing in Britain is the opportunity to get into wild places where there are big animals. That can be a little bit scary sometimes. You know, these are big cattle. They're safe, but there's an awesome and a wonder to them as well. We had that missing in many ways. So if you had to drill it down, I'd probably say that opportunity for reminding people and giving people the opportunity to see for themselves just how exciting and awesome nature and wild things can be.
Richard Bunting is the spokesperson for Trees for Life, a group that's reintroducing wild cattle to the Scottish Highlands.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It has become a common story around the world, rising temperatures and decreased rainfall leading to parched conditions. Experts say climate change is part of the problem. In North Africa, Morocco is looking at yet another year of drought. Yesterday, we reported on how that drought is hurting farmers and food supplies. The country is trying to adapt and prepare for a future that could be even more arid. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from central Morocco.
In a laboratory in the city of Benguadir, a round glass-encased platform about 5 feet across spins in a slow circle. Inside, 12 tiny potted lentil seedlings arranged under lights like the numbers on a clock.
We are planting lentil inside the machine, and we are controlling temperature, humidity, CO2, water, and to make the condition that we want to test our material.
Researcher Nourdine Al-Haddad calls this contraption his mimic machine because he can set it to simulate the exact conditions of any farming region in the country. For example,
Barzouga is the city in the east of Morocco, characterized by very hot temperatures. So we use the same condition to test our material in the same location.
Inside the machine, some of the sprigs have withered. Others are resisting Merzouga's drought-like stresses. Those tougher plants are the ones Al-Haddad wants to understand and propagate.
First, we are identifying the mechanism of resistance or tolerance of the plant. Okay. So we know how the plant tolerate or resist drought, for example. After that, our objective is to understand this mechanism and to improve other varieties that are more resilient to climate change.
For Morocco, in the absence of rainfall, developing new drought-resistant crops is urgent. Yields of traditional wheat, a staple for most Moroccans, are down 50% and dropping. Al-Haddad's team has already identified candidates like the cereal millet or cowpea, a legume from sub-Saharan Africa. These are all plants that react to drought by retaining water. But getting them from a lab to the fields will take time. Morocco needs to save water now. To do that, the country is mimicking these plants in a way. by retaining water where it can. On an olive plantation in northern Morocco, farmer Badir Labouezi says the government has helped him slash his water use by swapping out wasteful sprinklers with drip irrigation.
We are using only drop by drop, because you reduce by four the consumption of water. That's why the government give us money to put all these projects in place, because I have 200 hectares. And they give me something like 65% of the amount of the investment.
But on farms like Labouezi's, water is still in short supply. It usually comes from wells, and as the rain lessens, the wells are drying up. If water no longer comes from underground or the sky, says Labouezi,
the solution, I think, it's coming from the sea.
Morocco is betting big on seawater by building plants that remove the salt. Here, just south of Casablanca, the country's biggest desalination facility is under construction. When it's up and running, the plant will pump out up to 1 million cubic meters of fresh water per day. That would cover the needs of around 90,000 homes. Climate change scientist and consultant Mohamed Jalil says desalination is key to making up for lost water, but there are challenges.
Because this kind of process is consuming a lot of energy, so we need also to do a kind of nexus between energy and water production using renewable energy.
Renewable as in solar. Morocco has the largest concentrated solar power plant in the world, but it needs to build more to run any new desalination plants. Desalination also creates toxic brine that, if pumped back into the ocean, can destroy local ecosystems. Jalil says there's no magic wand when it comes to adapting to climate change.
But I think that we should integrate a lot of solutions: water from the sea, water from wastewater, water from the transfer from the north to the south, in order to have a comprehensive solution and integrated solution for the region, for example, for Casablanca.
And on a global level, he says, nations ultimately need to cooperate on curbing carbon emissions, the root cause of climate change and the havoc it can wreak. Havoc and headaches. Cities like Casablanca have imposed major water restrictions. It's turned off fountains, stopped watering lawns in public parks, and washing your car, no can do. A young man named Hassan Hikmao pulls up to a gas station car wash. He says he was hoping to scrub down his VW before going out that night, but the place is shuttered. It's annoying, he says, that I have to go to a party in my dusty wheels, but we have to accept this and just pray for rain. Look at the countryside here, he says, it's all yellow. A few years ago, this was all green. Banning car washes isn't that big a deal, but the water restrictions cut deeper. At sundown on a recent evening in Casablanca, the call to prayer from Muslims also signals the end of the workday and bath time. In Morocco, that means a trip to the public baths, or hammams, for millions of people. But it's a Monday. They're closed. Abdel Latif Fadouachi, head of Morocco's Hammam Association, says the hammams can now only open from Thursday to Sunday. Our clients are really complaining about these closures, he says. Imagine the people who work with fish all day or as mechanics. They need to shower every day. It's a human right. For women, the hammams are even more important, says his wife, Fatima Fadouachi. It's one of the main places, she says, where women can socialize openly. We go to the hammam before our wedding, she says, before and after giving birth. Even if we're just going to visit a friend, we first meet in the hammam. Our lives, she says, start and end with the hammam. Abdel Latif says closing the country's 50,000 public baths makes little sense. People, he says, will just bathe at home with the precious drinking water that comes out of their taps. He's got a point, but Morocco's hoping its multi-pronged adaptation to drought will ultimately be enough, even if every solution has a difficult downside. Like scientist Mohamed Jalil says, there's no magic wand when you're running out of water. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Casablanca, Morocco.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll catch you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Patchwork Collective, Lillianne and Ed Schneider, the Gruber Family Foundation, and the Lucy and Ken Lehman Family. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.